Our next guest is a respected private equity journalist who reached fame with the Wall Street Journal and is about to embark upon her next adventure. Join us for her reflections on the evolution of journalism and what she learned while repeatedly scooping the private equity industry over the years. I'm Ethan Devitt, and welcome to the 50 Faces podcast, a podcast committed to revealing the richness and diversity of the world of investment by focusing on its people and their stories. I'm joined today by Preeti Singh, who was until recently an LP reporter on the private equity area at the Wall Street Journal. She graduated from the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University and has worked in a range of roles in financial journalism. She has spent time as a content manager for a publishing company in executive search prior to entering journalism, and is known for her ability to cultivate deep relationships across the industry and to get the first scoop on industry moves. Welcome, Preeti. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Ethan. Very, very excited.
Well, let's start with your background and career journey. Can you tell us where you grew up and how you ultimately came to enter journalism and financial journalism in particular?
Yes, for sure. So I grew up in many small townships in India because my dad used to work in steel. So I grew up in India and in Syria, where my dad also went to work in steel. And I think because I travel so much, I love to observe people and listen to their stories. And from whenever I remember, I wanted to be a reporter and a journalist. So after I finished my undergraduate in India, I took the written test for one of the best journalism schools in India. I passed the written test and I went for the interview, but I think the guy hated me. He threw me out of the room in, like, I think 10 seconds flat, saying they did not need people like me. And so I came back home and my mom said, well, it seems like your journalism dreams are over. So why don't you do an MBA? And I did do an MBA. I'm really glad I did it. I worked for many, many years, thoroughly enjoyed it, but I always wanted to write. So we moved to the US in 2013. And I thought that was a good time to sort of explore something new. And I was writing a book at the time. And I wrote the book in the Scarsdale Library, which is where I live. And after I finished writing the book, I wrote an article on the library and sent it to the Scarsdale Inquirer, the local newspaper. To my utter delight, it got published. And the editor called me for coffee. And at the end of it, she gave me a column called Notes from a Newcomer and told me to write about things that I found unique and interesting in Scarsdale. And so I wrote about everything from the American prom to Thanksgiving to the first snow, just literally everything. And I realized that this was the kind of writing I wanted to do. I love my byline. So I started freelancing. I did that for about 2 years. And then I figured that if this is really what I wanted to do, I needed to go back to school and tool up. So that's how I landed up at the Columbia Journalism School. And I realized pretty early that business journalism could be a sweet spot for me just because I had a background working in companies. I understood how companies work. I understood how professionals thought. So I thought that could be a really sweet spot for me. And so that's how I really got into journalism. My first role was a trade publication that covered distressed debt. I did not like that at all. After 6 months, I gave it 6 months and I left it. And that's when the executive editor of Buyouts Insider, which covered US private equity, reached out to me and asked if I would like to cover private equity. And I said yes. And I started with covering family offices and foundations and endowments and smaller pension systems. And I haven't looked back. I loved covering private equity.
Well, you're a true asset to the space. I want to just go back into a few pieces of your background that you mentioned there. Firstly, he threw you out of the room in the interview in an unceremonious way, it seemed, suggesting that he didn't want people like you. What do you think he meant by people like you? What did you evince during the interview that you think maybe led you not to hit at all?
I think I pissed him off, really, because he asked me 5 questions. He asked me what newspaper I read, and then he asked me a few questions. He said, how many columns did the first paper have? What was on the editorial page today? And a bunch of questions, and I did not know the answers to those. And I think he got really mad at me for that. In hindsight, I'm really glad he did that, because I think I went back to journalism as a more mature person with more empathy and also the ability to be able to withstand the high pressure that comes with being a journalist. So I'm really glad he threw me out.
I love that. And then you mentioned going to write a book. What was the book about? because I'm loving this idea of being inspired by your surroundings to actually write about that library. But what was the book?
So it's called Unravel. It's 8 short stories linked together into a novel set in Mumbai, because that's where I was from when I moved. Yeah, I published it. It's with a producer who's optioned it to convert it into a TV series. So I don't know what's happening with that. I'll figure when I go back.
Very exciting. And of course, when you say go back, you are about to return to Mumbai, which is the occasion of this recording. So a great new chapter about to open. So just in terms of looking at journalism as a career, you mentioned going to it in a more mature way. And you said that financial journalism may have been a sweet spot. This is against a backdrop for maybe all of journalism having a bit of an existential crisis, given the way print journalism is evolving and the advent of digital journalism. Do you have any thoughts from the inside as to the evolution of the profession and maybe how it will continue to evolve?
Well, I think it's changed a lot from even a decade ago. So there's print, there's digital, there's audio, there's video, there's all kinds of multimedia in that. And I think there's been like a lot of upheaval, but I do think that it's settled down, because the things that make a good journalist remain the very same. The things that make for good reporting remain the very same. It is a very tough profession. It requires a lot of, I think, courage to be able to write about things. And I think that hasn't changed. Sourcing, integrity, writing a fact-based piece, those things haven't changed. And I think through the upheavals, people have sort of realized that. So you do see subscriptions of well-respected newspapers going up. So I think it's changed, but pretty much has remained the same in many ways.
It's really interesting, because I think there probably has been an advent, an army of citizen journalists with the ease at which anyone can post a blog. And those journalists don't have, or if you call them journalists, don't have that training, as you mentioned, in the integrity, the need for evidence, the need for fact bases, and I suppose of that courage that you mentioned. So it's interesting, maybe on the fringes, that it is being eroded by non-professionals, I suppose, exercising it.
I think that the really professional journalists are the ones that keep themselves out of the story. And I think that that's really critical to reporting well.
Really interesting. No, that's great. And now I'm fascinated by the area you write about, private equity. It has an endless stream of personalities. It certainly has attracted its fair share of bad press, as well as a lot of scrutiny. Can you talk about the topics you've written about that have gained most traction, maybe some of the articles that got the most responses?
I think journalism and reporting is really about gossip, official gossip. So people love those kind of stories. Everybody wants to know who's raising how much money, who's changing jobs, who's going where. What are the trends? What are other companies doing? What are other private equity companies doing with their portfolio companies? So those kind of stories always get a lot of interest. I think I was at a very special time covering this industry, especially during the pandemic. And a lot of those stories got a lot of traction, just in terms of how investors were dealing with their portfolio companies, how they were valuing, because M&A had completely stopped and private equity firms were trying to understand how to deal with their portfolio companies. I think that was a really special time. A lot of those stories got a lot of traction. And again, this year with the market volatility, just in terms of how private equity was behaving or what managers were really thinking about. So I think those kind of stories, trend pieces, well-researched pieces, really found a lot of traction with our readers.
And in terms of any trends you see that excite you as subject matter, does that go with maybe a sector like, say, biotech or healthcare? Or is it around some of the products that are evolving, like we talk about the tech platforms, as well as the democratization of private equity? Is there anything in particular that you enjoy writing about?
Well, one of the things that I saw last year that we were not writing about was secondaries. And I could see that that was becoming a very, very hot space as more and more general partners try to hold on to their best companies. We did not have anybody reporting on that. So I basically added that to my beat because I thought that was really interesting. And I think that's a huge part of the market, and we'll continue to see a lot of movement there. I think there's a lot of excitement happening in private equity, whether it is GP stakes, just the sheer number of private equity firms selling a stake of themselves to somebody else. There's that. There's so many new structures for fundraising that are evolving. The sheer increase in fund sizes amongst general partners is very interesting to see. And I think now the push for retail investors is interesting. So you've got like the larger asset managers really pushing and putting their efforts in educating and trying to get on retail investors onto their platforms. And I think that's going to be where we'll see a lot of action in the next few years.
Well, that's a good segue to my next question, which is around the general public level of understanding around private equity as a segment of finance. Certainly, as I said, it's been bashed in the media. They were the old barbarians of the gate back in the 1980s. And perhaps, is it well understood by the retail investor from your vantage point? What do you see?
Well, to tackle the first question in terms of negative press, I think some of that might be warranted. I shouldn't say warranted, justified maybe, just because the fund sizes have become really large. So private equity continues to be the top returning asset class for most institutional investors. And they do return a lot of capital back to their investors, but they also have outsized returns for themselves. And while the fund sizes have increased, the 220 model hasn't changed. So they're still charging a hefty management fee, a hefty carried interest or their share of profits. So I think some of that is definitely warranted. I think it also receives negative press every time a hospital chain is shut down or some other business gets shut down. And I think that is a bit unfair because the role of business is to be sustainable and to generate profits. And so private equity is really trying to make sure that those businesses are sustainable. And if they're not sustainable, they need to be shut down. And so many investors that I spoke with over the years hated closing down businesses or restructuring them or not having them in the shape that they wanted to. But I think that's the part of business. I mean, if it's not going to be sustainable, it has to go. You don't put good money after bad. So I think that's where it's a bit unwarranted. In terms of whether it's well understood by retail investors, I think there is a lot of sophisticated wealth advisors, sophisticated family offices that understand private equity. And I think right now there's a lot of push towards educating retail investors about private equity and investing in private equity. I think you're going to see a lot of that happening as more and more companies remain private for longer. The challenge I see there is really in terms of access to the best private equity funds and how those retail investors will get access to them. I think the larger asset managers are reaching them. But what I hear from most institutional investors is that they already consider those beta generators and not alpha generators. So I think the challenge for retail investors is going to be how to really get to those alpha generating funds.
I definitely want to come back to access because I think that is a critical point. So in the writing that you've done, where have you got some engagement? I know the Wall Street Journal has a comment page. And where do you find you're getting the most engagement from readers? Is it the kind of armchair quarterback who's a bit of an expert on finance, or do you find that there's broad-based engagement on the topics you write about?
Well, the Wall Street Journal readers are really the professional readers anyhow. So I think we see a lot of engagement from private equity managers or people in the private equity ecosystem. And we do see individuals also commenting, but I would say that usually the Wall Street Journal reader is a professional. And so it is really the professional crowd that is engaging with us.
Just to return to access. So this is often talked about as an access class, not an asset class. And even getting access to that kind of elite private circle or maybe magic circle of firms can be challenging. But you seem to have achieved that through just the work you do and I think the quality of what you do. What would your thoughts be on maybe the access? And I'm talking about in terms of diversity. Like how diverse do you think the industry is and how inclusive is it?
I do think that private equity is trying to increase diversity. And I mean, there's two places they try to increase diversity. One is diversity at their portfolio companies, which obviously employ a lot more people than private equity firms themselves have. So I think there is a real push, or at least from my reporting, in terms of increasing diversity at portfolio companies. I do think there is also a push to increase diversity at the private equity firms themselves. However, I do feel sometimes that they need to change their hunting grounds to increase that diversity. They're not going to find people in the usual areas that they look. So I do think they have to change. So when PE firms tell investors that we've been trying hard, but we can't find people, that's not true. I think they just need to change where they look for people. And I think they will come to that, but they haven't yet come to it.
And maybe just to take that broader to the journalism profession as well. How diverse have you found that through the course of your career?
Okay, I can only speak about business journalism because that's where I am. I found it a very diverse and inclusive place. whether it's gender diversity or ethnic diversity or racial diversity. I mean, literally, Effin, I have worked with people from across the world. And I think that is what made it really special, whether it was people from Ireland or Romania, Brazil, Portugal, like name it, I've worked with reporters from across the world. I think it made it a very, very rich place, just in terms of different perspectives and different ideas. So I do think that business journalism, at least from my experience, is fairly diverse and inclusive.
It's a really interesting point, because then I suppose I moved to the role that journalists play in helping to push the diversity, say, of the financial industry. And what I'm thinking there is amplifying less, perhaps, well-represented groups. And when you're looking for a quote, finding a female maybe to make that quote or someone from a different ethnic group. How have you seen your role in advancing the diversity of the industry?
Well, I think one of the things is that if you are moderating a panel, you always ensure that there are women, because you can't have like an all-male panel. So you try to ensure that there are women. And if there are women, then you look at racial diversity. Do you have people of different colors sitting on the panel? So I think that. And I think maybe I don't consider myself a diverse candidate, though actually I should. I'm older. I'm brown. I am all those. I'm a woman. I tick all those boxes. But I've always tried to include as many different voices as I could in my articles, in which meant not only diversity of like gender and race, but also diversity in terms of opinions of smaller private equity firms versus larger ones that get heard more often. So I think there's many ways of trying to increase inclusion, and a lot of us do try very hard to do that.
No, and thank you for the work you're doing. It has been noted and appreciated. Let's get back to your personal story now. So what were some of the highs and lows of the career you've had to this date?
I think the really low was really right at the beginning of my career. When I went to Columbia, I was the oldest person in the class. And so when we started recruiting, nobody wanted to recruit an older person. They all wanted entry-level interns. So that was very, very distressing for me at that time, because I wasn't sure if I'd made the right choice. And I think my first role was, even though I learned all my reporting chops there, was absolutely the most distressing one for me, because I did not enjoy that writing. And I think it made me a very unhappy person for those 6 months that I was there. And in terms of highs and lows, I think we experience them every day. So if there is a scoop I've got, if there's a source that came through, if my editor was happy about my work, if readers wrote in to say they appreciated something we did, those are the highs in a day. By the same measure, the lows are if I got scooped and somebody else got a scoop ahead of me, or like a source soured on me, then those are the lows. So I think those happen every day.
I certainly do think of you as the queen of the scoop. So you obviously have more than average, which is great. Can you tell us a little bit about the chapter that lies ahead? I referred to it briefly, but it seems like an exciting one.
Yes. So I am moving to India for a couple of years, and I will be joining Bloomberg, and I'm going to cover banking. So like I told you earlier, I've never been a reporter in India. I haven't been in India for over a decade. So it's a completely new geography for me. Never covered banking. That's a completely new beat for me. So as a reporter, I think that's going to be very exciting to be in a new geography, covering a new beat, looking for new sources, trying to just understand the landscape. So I'm very, very excited. I think it's going to be hard work, but very exciting.
Well, having spent a few evenings at the Foreign Correspondents Club in Hong Kong back in the late 90s, it certainly was a very energetic and diverse community there. So I'm hoping you'll find something similar in Mumbai, which will be fascinating. Let's go to any key people in your career. Have you had mentors, sponsors, maybe a guiding light that you learned from?
I think there were so many. And I got really, really lucky, Effin, because I think I found many people who were very patient with me, took time to talk to me, explain concepts to me, and really supported me, whether if they did not want to be quoted, they still gave me a lot of information just so that I understood something. There's many, many of them, and I can't name them because a good journalist never names the sources. So I genuinely cannot name them, but there have been some really insanely good people I met who've helped me every step of the way.
That's really interesting. So taking the time to explain a concept in detail is clearly a win-win, because it's in everyone's interest that something isn't misconstrued or miscommunicated or overly simplified, perhaps. But did you find that you always had the time, given that there's often the deadline, et cetera, and there's maybe a desire to get a scoop? As a journalist, do you have the time often to get that detailed explanation? Because I think if you do, it's great to know. It's something we should all do is take more time to ensure that a story is well conveyed?
Yes, I think so. So they're the dailies and the scoops that you do. I actually never refused a call with anybody. So if any PR person wrote to me asking me to speak to someone, I always did, whether it concerned private equity directly or indirectly, because I felt like I always learned a lot from people. And if there was something that I wanted to write about, like for instance, in secondaries, I knew nothing about it. So I wanted to learn about it. So I can only write meaningfully when I learn something about a topic. So I really looked at those as learning opportunities. And I always, always made time. So like literally at least a day in the week would be the one that I would always, always just spend time on the phone talking to people.
And in terms of any words of wisdom, maybe that some of these anonymous sources may have ever conveyed to you, any words to live by, or maybe any way that they live their lives that you thought left an impression on you. Can you share anything there?
I think they're all really wonderful people and they were very transparent about what they did. And I learned from them that you could be really, really high up in the organization, but that you needed to have tremendous integrity. So it's not that they were passing on any information that they should not have passed on to me. They're very high on integrity. And they were always punctual. I learned punctuality from them. Like they were on the call before I was there. And they genuinely went over and beyond what was required of them to ensure that I understood something correctly. It's easy for me to say that I made time for them because that's my profession, but they have fuller schedules than me and they made a lot of time for me. Some of them would call me over the weekends if I needed something urgently. I really respect that because they did not have a stake in it in the sense that they were not being quoted in the articles or whatever, but they took time. And I really, really appreciate that. And I call that true charity because nobody knows who they were, but they absolutely helped me every step of the way.
Well, it's really interesting to kind of derive the keys to their success when you hear about how they operate when no one is looking, essentially, which is that behind the scenes type of work. What are the areas, because I would be, say, an investor in private equity, we look at, it's such a people business. We mentioned looking at the strength of management, the integrity, now at succession planning, because obviously some of the very big groups are now going to have their second generation take over. And that's a risk, I suppose, to the business. In your experience of watching these personalities evolve, how often have you seen some maybe lose their investment mojo or drift style or really lose what made them successful in the first place? Is that something you've seen a lot?
Actually, I don't see that a lot because I think what I truly appreciate about private equity investors is how focused they are. They're very micro-focused, laser-focused on what makes them successful. And a lot of them, I think, continue to chase that. I really haven't seen style drifts in most of the people I've seen come up the ranks and become senior leaders in their companies. Where I have seen changes in them is in terms of the way they begin to give back to their communities. A lot of them we haven't written about either, a lot of them that do not want to be written about, but a lot of them give back to their communities in a really big way. And a lot of them try to mentor the younger generation. So I think I see those changes. I haven't really seen them change intrinsically in terms of the kind of investors they are.
That would certainly be reassuring from our perspective. And it is interesting that you mention this silver lining, because that's something I've always stressed as a silver lining of some of the tremendous wealth that gets created in the space of private equity and venture capital, is that generally there is a philanthropic angle later in the course of the career, whole foundations that have been set up, maybe committed to marine conservation or to education. And I think maybe it does deserve some coverage, given that that's the kind of the flip side of some of the negative press that this gets. So a very interesting point.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Preeti. It's been a joy to watch your journalism career evolve, the short space I've been following you. And I'm incredibly excited for what the next chapter holds for you. I look forward to seeing more scoops on the banking sector coming out of Mumbai. And thank you for sharing your insights you've gleaned from all these years of working in the private equity industry here with us. Thank you for your service to the industry and for those of us who are watching your every word.
Oh, I don't know what service I provided, but thank you so much. I'm deeply humbled you chose to interview me. Thanks, Evan.
I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to the 50 Faces podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring investors and their personal journeys, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.